So, yes, tomorrow marks 1 year since 51 people died. Many more were injured at two mosques in Christchurch. The man accused of shooting those people will stand trial in June. At the Al Noor Mosque, Dr. Maysoon Salama's son, Atta Alayan, was killed, and her husband, Muhammad Alayan, was injured. Dr. Salama and her husband run a childcare centre in Christchurch, the Al Noor Centre. They've set up another in Dunedin. And she is also national coordinator for the Islamic Women's Council of New Zealand. I suggested to Dr. Salama that while the broader public feels the need to mark the event which changed so much for New Zealand, those most involved might wish we didn't.
Sometimes, yeah, that's how I feel, because I'd like to move on. But I think it's also important
to remember.
It's important, yes, to remember our loved ones. Mm-hmm. We live their legacy every day. And for us as Muslims, we don't have an annual, you know, Remembrance Day. For us, you know, once the janazah is done, 3 days, we close the chapter, but we still live the legacy of our loved ones, and we move on with our lives.
So you want to remember your loved ones, but not necessarily to remember that day.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. So I feel guilty asking you this question, but what were you doing on that day?
On that day, I was at work. I work in a childcare center, and we had the children around and the staff, and we didn't know what was happening until a few of the parents started arriving, and we've been told that there has been shooting in the mosque, and this is where we started knowing, you know, what's happening. And
and you knew that your son and your husband were at the Al Noor Mosque?
Yes, definitely, because before going to the mosque, you know, they both came and said goodbye, we'll see you later, because, you know, my son was away in Auckland the night before for his business, and then he came back and we were missing him, and he was asking me, Mom, what are the plans today? And then I told him, you know, that both Dad and I are planning to go to Dunedin because we have another center there, and I'll see you at lunch, so we'll have lunch together, and I've cooked today. He normally asks this question, you know, most of the time, because we're always together and we eat together and spend a lot of time together. So, yeah, he gave, you know, there was lots of other discussions before he went, and they went earlier to the mosque. His dad went before him, and he went after that. Yes, and I was hoping to see him after the prayer, but it didn't happen, unfortunately.
How is your husband now?
He's doing well. He's recovering, and he's a strong man. He has, you know, a strong will, and he's trying to move on with life also and moving forward. It's been hard because, you know, his injury was severe. And of course, you know, there is another injury, you know, the loss of his son and the loss of so many of his friends. It's plus the trauma, you know, he has witnessed all what was happening. He was from the first ones to be shot, but he was still conscious and he was hearing and following what's happening.
How's he dealt with that, the trauma?
It's been very hard for him. He was quiet most of the time. He wouldn't share what he has really seen or witnessed. But he was really resorting to lots of prayer, lots of, you know, being by himself and praying even in the middle of the night and supplicating. It took him a long time before he would share any of the information that he's having.
And did he do it with you, or did he have a counselor?
He refused to have a counselor. Many of the men, I think, you know, they don't feel that they really can express their feelings to counselors, you know, but for him, yeah, it was through discussions, both me and him, and I was trying also to speak to him and comfort him And I think he was trying to be strong for all of the family, because we were all really in a very difficult situation, you know, losing our son and all of our friends, who many of them we have spent probably the past 20 years since we came to New Zealand. I've been here for 25 years at least, and many of those people who we lost are very close friends.
Do you think that men should learn to talk to counsellors, or they should just be left to deal with it as they see fit?
I think they should learn, you know, because there is a need, especially nowadays, you know, there is, you know, I'm a scientist, and I believe in, you know, like science and the benefits of science, you know, so mental health is really important, like the normal issues of health. So if you don't go to the doctor for any other issue, then you should also go for other issues which are mental. So I believe we need to encourage men to go to, you know, counselors, and yeah, because there'll be definitely a benefit from that.
Could you have been at the mosque that day?
I haven't been in the mosque, no. Because what happened, we were still in the center, and I, you know, like, I got a call from my husband while he was injured, and he was in the emergency, and I, you know, this is after I came to know that there is, you know, shooting in the mosque. Yeah. So he called me, and he said, "Maysoon, you must have heard by now that there has been shooting in the mosque. Please don't come to the hospital. I'm in the emergency. I'm okay. You have a responsibility. You have at least 25 kids, you know, with you. So you stay there, please. Lock the gates, close the curtains, and just look after the children, and I'll be fine." I asked him about Ata. He said, "I haven't seen him, and I'll be all right, so please don't come to the hospital." And, yeah, so since that, you know, we've done our part, and we stayed with the children. It wasn't until 8:30 when I was able to arrive to the hospital, and by that time, I knew that my husband is injured, but I never knew that he is really severely injured, because he sounded okay, and I wasn't even much worried about him. He spoke to me really nicely. But I've also heard by then that, you know, my son was shot. We didn't know what's his stage. And then, you know, when the last child have left the center, I was able to go and you know, start looking for my loved ones, what happened to my son or my husband.
I can hear the children at the creche in the background, yeah?
Yes, yeah, they are now playing happily and bubbly.
They must, all of them, have been affected in some way by the shooting?
Yes, definitely so. You know, the first day for them, you know, because we were like kind of doing a lockdown, and things were really difficult, and parents started coming traumatized and crying, and so they have sensed all of that. Then we closed for 2 weeks, and after 2 weeks, we could see a change in the, you know, well-being of the children. Many of them definitely have been, like, maybe around hospitals, and maybe they have been seeing police, and they have been, you know, seeing a lot of chaotic situations that they are not used to. So that definitely changed a lot, you know, for, you know, the norms that they are used to.
How did you deal with that?
We really started thinking even before we opened, you know, about the situation, because we've been also like seeing we're very close to each other, you know, and so we started planning, you know, how are we going to deal with the children? We were expecting that there will be changes. One of the children also was my granddaughter, so I could see all of the changes. She's asking about dad every day, and she's like wondering what's happening, where is he? So we started really communicating with the ministry, researching ourselves what to do in situations like this, trauma for young children. We reached out, you know. So we started, you know, changing the curriculum for the children, and more quiet play and more fun activities, and the quiet play kind of in preparation for teaching them the lockdown and safety issues. Then we started talking about loss, because many of our children have lost loved ones, and some of them have, you know, are dealing with injured family members. So, we talked about loss, even from losing a balloon, a pet, to losing a dad. We started also like talking with them, you know, and somehow something similar to a group therapy where we would talk to the children all together and those who have lost loved ones and, you know, saying, well, okay, you know, dad is in paradise, in a better place, you know, so trying to deal with this in a positive way so that they know also that they are not alone in this and support each other, have empathy and we talked about relationships, about emotions. So we had to deal with all of this. And we did also communicate with the mental health, you know, and we are in touch with a lady who is really specialized in this field for children, a psychologist, and she is now visiting the center at least once a week. So lots of that has been happening, you know, and for me, I reached out even for the prime minister, you know, expressing that mental health on a long and a short term is really very important for children and the community in general. And she acted on that, which was really great, you know, and the district health board also. So I was like involved in meetings and discussing, you know, the issues that are related to the mental health issue. And we took it from there.
In some ways, it might be easier to help children than to help adults who might be slower to demonstrate that they need it?
Definitely so, yeah, because, you know, I was also involved with adults, but the children, you know, it didn't take them a long time before they would really, like, go back to the normal situation or the, you know, close to normal. I can't say normal because some of them still they are having, like, every time something happens at home or there is, you know, like the court hearing, for example, or a visit, you know, of two parents together and the child who is not having the father, then they will remember that, where's my dad? Mm-hmm. So you could see changes in behavior also sometimes coming back after, you know, like, but with adults, many of them are still really trying to cope with the situation and many of them are still, you know, not moving forward easily. So I feel, you know, children are probably, you know, easier to mold and help.
I'm talking to Dr. Maysoon Salama, whose son was killed at the Al Noor Mosque last March the 15th and her husband injured. What about you?
Me? I've been trying to be as strong as possible.
I know.
And I'm feeling the responsibility and I feel, you know, like keeping myself busy with something which is fruitful also and helpful to the community is giving me the pleasure and giving me the strength of moving forward and making progress. It tickles my heart always when I do things and I see the fruits of what I have done or what I have tried, you know, to pursue.
Did you say it tickles your heart?
It does.
That's nice. Do you feel like things have progressed? Do you feel like you've been able to get things addressed? I mean, we know that the authorities failed to respond to the threats that you reported to them, and the Royal Commission's been hearing that. How are you feeling about that now?
Sometimes I have mixed feelings, but in general, I can say that there is, you know, like progress which is happening. It is slow, but we understand that it will be slow. It will take time. So as long as there is progress, there is hope. So I can see lots of progress happening, even though it's not, you know, very, very quick. But people are listening, people are genuine in responding. Systems need to be looked at and lots of changes need to be happening, you know.
What kind of systems? What kind of changes?
I think, you know, like there is should be changes in the education system, for example, and in also certain policies that have to do with counter-terrorism, you know, and counterterrorism, for example, you know, it's we need to shift the focus from just focusing on certain group of people. Basically, Muslims are the terrorists in the eyes of people and people who are working towards counterterrorism, you know. So, but now there should be a shift to there is other groups who are also terrorists. So we need to look at them and they have to be under the radar. So changes in that direction, you know, for intelligence and other people, you know, need to be happening. And in the education system, you know, I believe in education and I think it's the key also. So I believe, you know, in the curriculum and there should be a focus, you know, on introducing, you know, certain things about different cultures, you know, and we need to start even from early childhood to tertiary education. Dealing with issues that have to do with inclusion and connectedness and, you know, changing the social norms in these issues. Policies, probably also like not only the government, the NGOs and social media platforms and, you know, like policies in how to address hate speech and hate speech need to be redefined. Yeah, so action is needed.
Did you establish a Muslim childcare centre because you feared, I don't know, discrimination if your children went to mainstream childcare?
The reason I established the childcare, you know, is...
it was New Zealand's first Muslim yes. childcare centre, yeah?
Yes, it is the first Muslim childcare centre. I want to have to say, you know, that early childhood wasn't my field and it wasn't planned, you know. But for me, you know, I when I came here, my husband was offered a job and for me, I was declined a job. So I had to find something, you know, and it was the idea of my husband that we both believe in education. So at that time, I had my daughter who was young, so we decided that we can start a childcare center because there is a need for that. And I've been through this situation when I was in the States as a PhD student. My son was 2.5 years, who's matured now. And he struggled because he didn't know the language. And I was like a student and my husband was a student. So we had to put him in childcare. So this is where the idea came that, you know, you need to have something, you know, to help the different cultures, you know, to raise their children in the way which is culturally appropriate for them. So that was where the idea of Islamic-based childcare came. Yeah, because there is, you know, things that we really care for and we would like our children to be, you know, like raised, you know, in a certain way.
That's not separatism in any way.
It's not indeed, you know, because for us, like the childcare center, we are like open to children from all walks of life. The only thing is that there are certain morals and concepts, you know, that we would like the children to really grow, having those instilled in them. And being in the field for so many years, you know, I know that the first 5 years of the child's life is very important and it shapes the personality. So there are certain things which are important in our religion that we really need to start from an early age with our children. And for us, we teach them love, we teach them care, we teach them that we're all together. There's a verse in Islam, you know, that says, it's a beautiful one. وَجَعَلْنَاكُمْ شُعُوبًا وَقَبَائِلَ لِتَعَارَفُوا. We created you from nations and tribes so that you know one another, you know. So for us, we still, you know, have other children who are not Muslims. We take them from all walks of life and we teach them love and care and no difference in any colors or, you know. So we teach them the right things from the beginning, from the early start.
You and your husband are Palestinian, I think, and came to New Zealand via Kuwait and the United States. When you said your husband got employment here and you did not, why did you come to New Zealand?
He was offered a job. And at that time, you know, I was in the States, I was working and he has finished his PhD and he was looking for a job because we had like some incident also happening, you know, that we left the States. after the Gulf War, which was in Kuwait, and we used to live in Kuwait and our family in Kuwait. So we went to see them, and then we were denied access again to the States. And at that time, he had finished his PhD, and he was working on a project, and I was still, I haven't defended my thesis. And we stayed there for 6 months, not allowed to come back to the States. And that was, for me, it was a disaster. So when I, when we managed to come back with the help of our supervisors and our friends there, he lost his job already because, you know, somebody else had to take the job while he was away for 6 months. And I had to defend my thesis, you know. So so he was waiting, you know, until I finished. And I finished, and then I was working, you know, and I was offered a job in the States also. But for him, he was offered a job in New Zealand. So we moved to New Zealand. And at that time, my supervisor said, well, there is a job for you, my student. It's tailored for you, and it's in Canterbury University. So let's apply. So I applied. And then I didn't get any response. And for him, you know, he said, okay, you know, he asked me to come to the office and said, we will call them now. And he did. But then his face turned red and he was shocked. He said, you were really like eliminated from the first round. And for him, it was a big shock because I was offered a very good job, you know, in the States. And I was an outstanding student and I had a patent. And so for him, you know, it's he was shocked. And for me, I felt, well, why is that? Is it because I'm wearing the hijab? Is it because I'm Muslim? You know, so all this was in my mind. And when I came here, he got his job and he was like working. And for me, I didn't even feel like I want to apply for any jobs.
So you're fairly convinced that it was because you are Muslim, you wear the hijab?
I believe so, and I still believe so, because there is lots of, you know, like there isn't opportunities for Muslim ladies. They are starting to being offered some, you know, opportunities. But before, when I first came, we could see a lot of discrimination, and jobs are really not easy for Muslim ladies. I had a lot of ladies who, you know, after I started the center would come to me and say, well, do you have a job for me? Because I've tried. And they're all experienced and they're all having degrees, you know, not necessarily from New Zealand, but they are not having the chances.
You mentioned you have a patent. What's the patent in?
The patent is that my project was in dairy industry, in the genetic engineering field. So the dairy industry was suffering in the States for 30 years, and the strains that they use for making the cheese were getting very weak, and they were attacked by viruses, so the dairy industry was threatened. So my project is to develop a technique to isolate those special strains, which are good from nature because they are in low numbers. And I managed to really sequence the genes and then have a special probe and then isolate, you know, strains from, you know, the environment. And I named those strains also with, you know, so, and they have used them in the dairy industry there in the States. So, yeah, so I have a patent for that.
Did you make any money out of the patent?
I was a student, but they were really nice. So I was here in New Zealand when the patent was, you know, like finalized. And my supervisor, they sent me a check of some money, but most of the money went to the university. As a student, you don't get, you know, the regular money coming from a patent.
So it goes. I'm talking to Dr. Maysoon Salama. Will you attend the official memorial ceremony?
I think our family decided not to. So, yeah, we will just stay at home and do our normal business.
And the reason for that would be, as you explained earlier, you would rather remember your loved ones rather than what happened on that day.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and like I said, you know, we will never forget them. They're always, you know, in life. There is... every time there are things, you know, lots of triggers, you know, even a meal that he used to love or the stadium where he was playing. And his daughter, just for me, any minute I see his daughter, my granddaughter, Aya, you know, it's like she's the continuation of him, you know. So many times when I see her, I cry deep inside, you know, my heart breaks in halves, you know, millions of times. So he's always there around us, you know, his brother and sister, the same thing, his wife, his father, all of us, you know, he will be around us. He's, you know, like he will never be forgotten. And also the other, you know, Mateus, we know he's in a better place. And we want just to live our lives following his legacy, and but not to be reminded of the day when he was really killed. And this is like oppression, and it's, we try to avoid that. And it's also against our religion, we feel, you know, because we're not supposed to be really like having this annual memory of death, or even annual memory of birthdays for us, you know. It's not really something in our religion.
You can understand how the wider public in some way needs to remember the day?
Yes, definitely, you know. So we're fine with that. We know it's done with a good intention, and it's really very nice of them. But yeah, people have their choices, you know. So it's we really appreciate what's being done, and it's a matter of choice. And
you know, I talked last week to Farid Ahmed, his wife Husna was killed. You will know them.
Yes, yeah, they are friends of us. I remember Husna very well. Yes, and we miss her dearly.
And he has, from very early stages, expressed forgiveness for the perpetrator. Do you also do that?
For me, no. I cannot forgive the criminal. He's given himself the authority to take the lives of 51 loved ones, and he doesn't have this authority. So I will never forgive him. And again, it's people's choice, you know. So if someone wants to forgive, it's really up to them. And if someone can reach that level of being really that for you know, because for me, I don't feel I have the right even to forgive, you know, because there is 51 souls that have been taken, you know, and their blood was shed. I cannot really forgive this person. He's a criminal. He's not a human.
How is your daughter-in-law, your son's widow, Faratella, I think, how is she getting on?
She's up and down, and she's really still, you know, not really coming into terms with the situation. She's a strong person. She's now in Jordan. She left with her mother, you know, when she was here with her for the past, you know, 6 months, but she's in Jordan now with Aya, and I hope she's getting better.
Did she leave because of the attack?
Well, definitely it's related to that, you know, because, yeah, for her, you know.
She couldn't stay. She didn't. No. She couldn't bring herself to stay any longer.
Yeah, it was hard, you know, because they needed their also families around them. Mm-hmm. Although we are there for her, and she lived with us, you know, for a couple of years. But for her, this is like a big tragedy. It's a big shock. And just, you know, being here for only almost less than 2 years, and then you are faced with such a tragedy, it's not easy on anyone. So she's a young wife, and it's really hard for her, and she has a young daughter, and there is millions of things which are going in her mind, definitely. So it's not going to be easy for her, you know. There is lots of confusion there, and there is lots of reflecting, and it's difficult.
There is talk of erecting some kind of official memorial to what happened that day and to the victims. How do you feel about that?
It's a good thing, as long as it's a small thing, you know, in remembrance of the 51 martyrs. So there is no harm in having something, you know, that people can go to whenever they choose to, and being there for the history that, yeah, this thing happened, and we still value these people who have, you know, their lives have been taken, you know, unfairly.
Did you?
I think also, sorry, yeah. My son, he's an architect, you know, and he's having also like a vision for that, you know, and he still would love to be maybe involved in this, you know, in memory of his brother.
Do you feel as if you got the support you needed from the community, from the government, from the wider community in the wake of the massacre?
There has been a lot of support, I have to say. Our community, it was really very difficult because for them, you know, who's going to help who? 51 families have been suffering. They all needed help. And those who were martyred, you know, are the most active ones, you know. So it was really hard. So our community needed a lot of support, yet they were still supportive for each other. The wider community were really amazing. You know, we were overwhelmed with the pouring love and aroha, cards, flowers, plants, visits. It was really fantastic, you know. The government also were supportive. So, they have been engaging with us. They have been also listening to what our needs are. They were trying to be very sensitive to our needs and our culture. So, yes, there was a lot of support, you know. Also, there was support from outside New Zealand. There has been a lot of people, professionals and normal people who came and visited and supported. And, of course, our families from overseas, you know, they have left everything behind and they came to be around us to support. And the support of the government to really give them the visas on time also and very quickly, that was impressive, you know, and it was a great thing.
You will be hoping that sooner rather than later you can stop speaking of this.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So I've been getting a lot of, you know, like phone calls also that people want to have interviews with me and all of that. And I feel really tired. And I feel, when is this chapter going to be closed and when our lives is going to go back to normal or semi-normal? Yeah, so it's really been an exhausting year. And with all what's happening, it's really difficult for all of us.
That's Dr. Mason Salama.